Giving a right to the more and its responsibility, and who now, creditably, rancorously, and vindictively, represent in word and deed disbelief in the master task and supremacy of philosophy. After all, how could it be otherwise? Science flourishes nowadays, and has the good conscience clearly visible on its countenance. While that to which the entire modern philosophy has gradually sunk, the remnant of philosophy of the present day excites distrust and displeasure, if not scorn and pity. Philosophy, reduced to a theory of knowledge, no more, in fact, than a diffident science of epochs and doctrine of forbearance, a philosophy that never gets behind the threshold and rigorously denies itself the right to enter. That is philosophy in its last throes, an end, an agony, something that awakens pity. How could such a philosophy rule? The dangers that beset the evolution of the philosopher are, in fact, so manifold nowadays that one might doubt whether this fruit could still come to maturity. The extent and towering structure of the sciences have increased enormously, and therewith also the probability that the philosopher will grow tired even as a learner, or will attach himself somewhere and specialize, so that he will no longer attain to his elevation, that is to say, his superspection, his circumspection, and his despection. Or he gets aloft too late, when the best of his maturity and strength is past, or when he is impaired, coarsened, and deteriorated, so that his view, his general estimate of things, is no longer of much importance. It is perhaps just the refinement of his intellectual conscience that makes him hesitate and linger on the way. He dreads the temptation to become a dilettante, a millipede, a mill antenna, and he knows too well that as a discerner, one who has lost his self-respect no longer commands, no longer leads, unless he should aspire to become a great play actor, a philosophical Cagliostro and spiritual rat catcher, in short, a misleader. This is in the last instance a question of taste, if it has not really been a question of conscience. To double once more the philosopher's difficulties, there is also the fact that he demands from himself a verdict, a yea or nay, not concerning science, but concerning life and the worth of life. He learns unwillingly to believe that it is his right and even his duty to obtain this verdict, and he has to seek his way to the right and the belief only through the most extensive, perhaps disturbing and destroying experiences, often hesitating, doubting, and dumbfounded. In fact, the philosopher has long been mistaken and confused by the multitude, either with the scientific man and ideal scholar, or with the religiously elevated, desensualized, desecularized visionary and God-intoxicated man. And even yet, when one hears anybody praised because he lives wisely or as a philosopher, it hardly means anything more than prudently and apart. Wisdom. That seems to the populace to be a kind of flight, a means and artifice for withdrawing successfully from a bad game. But the genuine philosopher, does it not seem so to us, my friends, lives unphilosophically and unwisely, above all, imprudently, and feels the obligation and burden of 100 attempts and temptations of life. He risks himself. Constantly, he plays this bad game. In relation to the genius, that is to say, a being who either engenders or produces both words understood in their fullest sense, the man of learning, the scientific average man, has always something of the old maid about him. For, like her, he is not conversant with the two principal functions of man. To both, of course, to the scholar and to the old maid, one concedes respectability, as if by way of indemnification. In these cases, one emphasizes the respectability, and yet, in the compulsion of this concession, one has the same admixture of vexation. Let us examine more closely. What is the scientific man? Firstly, a commonplace type of man with commonplace virtues, that is to say, a non-ruling, non-authoritative, and non-self-sufficient type of man. He possesses industry, patient adaptableness to rank and file, equability and moderation in capacity and requirement. He has the instinct for people like himself and for that which they require. For instance, the portion of independence and green meadow without which there is no rest from labor, the claim to honor and consideration, which, first and foremost, presupposes recognition and recognizability, the sunshine of a good name, the perpetual ratification of his value and usefulness, with which the inward distrust which lies at the bottom of the heart of all dependent men and gregarious animals has again and again to be overcome. The learned man, as is appropriate, has also maladies and faults of an ignoble kind. He is full of petty envy. He has a lynx eye for the weak points in those natures to whose elevations he cannot attain. He is confiding, yet only as one who lets himself go, but does not flow. And precisely before the man of the great current, he stands all the colder and more reserved. His eye is then like a smooth and irresponsive lake, which is no longer moved by rapture or sympathy. The worst and most dangerous thing of which a scholar is capable results from the instinct of mediocrity of his type, from the Jesuitism of mediocrity, which labors instinctively for the destruction of the exceptional man, and endeavors to break, or still better, to relax every bent bow. To relax, of course, with consideration, and naturally with an indulgent hand. To relax with confiding sympathy, that is the real art of Jesuitism, which has always understood how to introduce itself as the religion of sympathy. However gratefully one may welcome the objective spirit, and who has not been sick to death of all subjectivity and its confounded ipsissimosity, very own. In the end, however, one must learn caution, even with regard to one's gratitude, and put a stop to the exaggeration with which the unselfing and depersonalizing of the spirit has recently been celebrated, as if it were the goal in itself, as if it were salvation and glorification, as is especially accustomed to happen in the pessimist school, which is also, in its turn, good reasons for paying the highest honors to disinterested knowledge. The objective man, who no longer curses and scolds like the pessimist, the ideal man of learning in whom the scientific instinct blossoms forth fully after a thousand complete and partial failures, is assuredly one of the most costly instruments that exist. But his place is in the hand of one who is more powerful. He is only an instrument, we may say. He is a mirror. He is no purpose in himself. The objective man is, in truth, a mirror accustomed to prostration before everything that wants to be known, with such desires only as knowing or reflecting implies. He waits until something comes, and then expands himself sensitively, so that even the light footsteps and gliding past of spiritual beings may not be lost on his surface and film. Whatever personality he still possesses seems to him accidental, arbitrary, or, still oftener, disturbing. So much has he come to regard himself as the passage and reflection of outside forms and events. He calls up the recollection of himself with an effort, and not infrequently wrongly. He readily confounds himself with other persons. He makes mistakes with regard to his own needs, and here only is he unrefined and negligent. Perhaps he is troubled about the health or the pettiness and confined atmosphere of wife and friend, or the lack of companions and society. Indeed, he sets himself to reflect on his suffering, but in vain. His thoughts already rove away to the more general case, and tomorrow he knows as little as he knew yesterday how to help himself. He does not now take himself seriously and devote time to himself. He is serene, not from lack of trouble, but from lack of capacity for grasping and dealing with his trouble. The habitual complacence with respect to all objects and experiences, the radiant and impartial hospitality with which he receives everything that comes his way, his habit of inconsiderate good nature, of dangerous indifference as to yea and nay. Alas, there are enough of cases in which he has to atone for these virtues of his. And, as man generally, he becomes far too easily the dross of such virtues. Should one wish love or hatred from him, I mean love and hatred as God, woman, and animal understand them, he will do what he can and furnish what he can. But one must not be surprised if it should not be much, if he should show himself just at this point to be false, fragile, questionable, and deteriorated. His love is constrained. His hatred is artificial, and rather un-tour de force, a slight ostentation and exaggeration. He is only genuine so far as he can be objective. Only in his serene totality is he still nature and natural. His mirroring and eternally self-polishing soul no longer knows how to affirm, no longer how to deny. He does not command, neither does he destroy. I despise almost nothing, he says with Leibniz. Let us not overlook nor undervalue the almost. Neither is he a model man. He does not go in advance of anyone, nor after either. He places himself generally too far off to have any reason for espousing the cause of either good or evil. If he has been so long confounded with the philosopher, with the Caesarian trainer and dictator of civilization, he has had far too much honor. And what is more essential in him has been overlooked. He is an instrument, something of a slave, though certainly the sublimest sort of slave, but nothing in himself, almost nothing. The objective man is an instrument, a costly, easily injured, easily tarnished measuring instrument and mirroring apparatus, which is to be taken care of and respected. But he is no goal, not outgoing nor upgoing, no complimentary man in whom the rest of existence justifies itself, no termination, and still less a commencement, an engendering, or primary cause. Nothing hardy, powerful, self-centered, that wants to be master, but rather only a soft, inflated, delicate, movable potter's form that must wait for some kind of content and frame to shape itself thereto. For the most part, a man without frame and content, a selfless man. Consequently, also, nothing for women, in parentheses. When a philosopher nowadays makes known that he is not a skeptic, I hope that has been gathered from the foregoing description of the objective spirit, people all hear it impatiently. They regard him on that account with some apprehension. They would like to ask so many, many questions. Indeed, among timid hearers, of whom there are now so many, he is henceforth said to be dangerous. With his repudiation of skepticism, it seems to them as if they heard some evil threatening sound in the distance, as if a new kind of explosive were being tried somewhere, a dynamite of the spirit. Perhaps a newly discovered Russian nihiline, a pessimism of goodwill that not only denies, means denial, but, dreadful thought, practices denial. Against this kind of goodwill, a will to the veritable actual negation of life, there is, as is generally acknowledged nowadays, no better soporific and sedative than skepticism, the mild, pleasing, lulling poppy of skepticism, and Hamlet himself is now prescribed by the doctors of the day as the antidote to the spirit and its underground noises. Are not our ears already full of bad sounds, say the skeptics, as lovers of repose, and almost as a kind of safety police? This subterranean neigh is terrible. Be still, ye pessimistic moles. the skeptic, in effect, that delicate creature is far too easily frightened. His conscience is schooled so as to start at every nay, and even at that sharp, decided yea, and feel something like a bite thereby. Yea and nay, they seem to him opposed to morality. He loves, on the contrary, to make a festival to his virtue by a noble aloofness. While perhaps he says with Montaigne, "What do I know?" Or with Socrates, "I know that I know nothing." Or, "Here I do not trust myself, no door is open to me." Or, "Even if the door were open, why should I enter immediately?" Or, "What is the use of any hasty hypotheses? It might quite well be in good taste to make no hypotheses at all. Are you absolutely obliged to straighten at once what is crooked, to stuff every hole with some kind of oakum? Is there not time enough for that? Has not time leisure? Oh, ye demons, can ye not at all wait? The uncertain also has its charms. The Sphinx, too, is a Circe, and Circe, too, was a philosopher." Thus does a skeptic console himself, and in truth he needs some consolation. For skepticism is the most spiritual expression of a certain many-sided physiological temperament, which, in ordinary language, is called nervous debility and sickliness. It arises whenever races or classes, which have been long separated, decisively and suddenly blend with one another. In the new generation, which has inherited, as it were, different standards and valuations in its blood, everything is disquiet, derangement, doubt, and tentativeness. The best powers operate restrictively. The very virtues prevent each other growing and becoming strong. Equilibrium, ballast, and perpendicular stability are lacking in body and soul. That, however, which is most diseased and degenerated in such nondescripts is the will. They are no longer familiar with independence of decision or the courageous feeling of pleasure in willing. They are doubtful of the freedom of the will, even in their dreams. Our present-day Europe, the scene of a senseless, precipitate attempt at a radical blending of classes, and consequently of races, is therefore skeptical in all its heights and depths, sometimes exhibiting the mobile skepticism which springs impatiently and wantonly from branch to branch, sometimes with gloomy aspect, like a cloud overcharged with interrogative signs, and often sick unto death of its will. Paralysis of will. Where do we not find this cripple sitting nowadays? And yet, how bedecked oftentimes, how seductively ornamented. There are the finest gala dresses and disguises for this disease, and that, for instance, most of what places itself nowadays in the showcases as objectiveness, the scientific spirit, and pure voluntary knowledge is only decked out skepticism and paralysis of will. I am ready to answer for this diagnosis of the European disease. The disease of the will is diffused unequally over Europe. It is worst and most varied where civilization has longest prevailed. It decreases according as the barbarian still, or again, asserts his claims under the loose drapery of Western culture. It is, therefore, in the France of today, as can be readily disclosed and comprehended, that the will is most infirm. And France, which has always had a masterly aptitude for converting even the portentous crises of its spirit into something charming and seductive, now manifests emphatically its intellectual ascendancy over Europe by being the school and exhibition of all the charms of skepticism. The power to will and to persist, moreover, in a resolution is already somewhat stronger in Germany, and again, in the north of Germany, it is stronger than in central Germany. It is considerably stronger in England, Spain, and Corsica, associated with phlegm in the former and with hard skulls in the latter, not to mention Italy, which is too young yet to know what it wants and must first show whether it can exercise will. But it is strongest and most surprising of all in that immense middle empire where Europe, as it were, flows back to Asia, namely in Russia. There, the power to will has been long stored up and accumulated. There, the will, uncertain whether to be negative or affirmative, waits threateningly to be discharged, to borrow their pet phrase from our physicist. Perhaps not only Indian wars and complications in Asia would be necessary to free Europe from its greatest danger, but also internal subversion, the shattering of the empire into small states, and, above all, the introduction of parliamentary imbecility, together with the obligation of everyone to read his newspaper at breakfast. I do not say this as one who desires it. In my heart, I should rather prefer the contrary. I mean such an increase in the threatening attitude of Russia that Europe would have to make up its mind to become equally threatening, namely to acquire one will by means of a new caste to rule over the continent, a persistent, dreadful will of its own that can set its aims thousands of years ahead, so that the long spun out comedy of its petty statism and its dynastic as well as its democratic many-willedness might finally be brought to a close. The time for petty politics is past. The next century will bring the struggle for the dominion of the world, the compulsion to great politics. As to how far the new warlike age on which we Europeans have evidently entered may perhaps favor the growth of another and stronger kind of skepticism, I should like to express myself preliminarily merely by a parable, which the lovers of German history will already understand. That unscrupulous enthusiast for big, handsome grenadiers who, as King of Prussia, brought into being a military and skeptical genius, and therewith, in reality, the new and now triumphantly emerged type of German, the problematic, crazy father of Frederick the Great, and, on one point, the very knack and lucky grasp of the genius. He knew what was then lacking in Germany, the want of which was 100 times more alarming and serious than any lack of culture and social form. His ill will to the young Frederick resulted from the anxiety of a profound instinct. Men were lacking, and he suspected, to his bitterest regret, that his own son was not man enough. There, however, he deceived himself. But who would not have deceived himself in his place? He saw his son lapsed into atheism, to the esprit, to the pleasant frivolity of clever Frenchmen. He saw, in the background, the great bloodsucker, the spider skepticism. He suspected the incurable wretchedness of a heart no longer hard enough either for evil or good, and of a broken will that no longer commands, is no longer able to command. Meanwhile, however, there grew up in his son that new kind of harder and more dangerous skepticism. Who knows to what extent it was encouraged just by his father's hatred and the icy melancholy of a will condemned to solitude, the skepticism of daring manliness, which is closely related to the genius for war and conquest, and made its first entrance into Germany in the person of the great Frederick. This skepticism despises and nevertheless grasps. It undermines and takes possession. It does not believe, but it does not thereby lose itself. It gives the spirit a dangerous liberty, but it keeps strict guard over the heart. It is a German form of skepticism, which, as a continued Frederickianism, risen to the highest spirituality, has kept Europe for a considerable time under the dominion of the German spirit and its critical and historical distrust. Owing to the insuperably strong and tough masculine character of the great German philologists and historical critics, who, rightly estimated, were also all of them artists of destruction and dissolution, a new conception of the German spirit gradually established itself in spite of all romanticism in music and philosophy, in which the leaning towards masculine skepticism was decidedly prominent. Whether, for instance, as fearlessness of gaze, as courage and sternness of the dissecting hand, or as resolute will to dangerous voyages of discovery, to spiritualized North Pole expeditions under barren and dangerous skies. there may be good grounds for it when warm-blooded and superficial humanitarians cross themselves before this spirit. That fatalistic, ironic, Mephistophelian spirit, as Michelet calls it, not without a shudder. But if one would realize how characteristic is this fear of the man in the German spirit which awakened Europe out of its dogmatic slumber, let us call to mind the former conception which had to be overcome by this new one. And that it is not so very long ago that a masculinized woman could dare, with unbridled presumption, to recommend the Germans to the interest of Europe as gentle, good-hearted, weak-willed, and poetical fools. Finally, let us only understand profoundly enough Napoleon's astonishment when he saw Goethe. It reveals what had been regarded for centuries as the German spirit. "This is a man." That was as much to say, "But this is a man, and I only expected to see a German." Supposing, then, that in the picture of the philosophers of the future, some trait suggests the question whether they must not perhaps be skeptics in the last-mentioned sense. Something in them would only be designated thereby, and not they themselves. With equal right, they might call themselves critics, and assuredly they will be men of experiments. By the name with which I ventured to baptize them, I have already expressly emphasized their attempting and their love of attempting is this because as critics in body and soul, they will love to make use of experiments in a new and perhaps wider and more dangerous sense. In their passion for knowledge, will they have to go further in daring and painful attempts than the sensitive and pampered taste of a democratic century can approve of? There is no doubt these coming ones will at least be able to dispense with the serious and not unscrupulous qualities which distinguish the critic from the skeptic. I mean the certainty as to standards of worth, the conscious employment of a unity of method, the wary courage, the standing alone, and the capacity for self-responsibility. Indeed, they will avow among themselves a delight in denial and dissection, and a certain considerate cruelty which knows how to handle the knife surely and deftly even when the heart bleeds. They will be sterner, and perhaps not always towards themselves only, than humane people may desire. They will not deal with the truth in order that it may please them or elevate and inspire them. They will rather have little faith in truth, bringing with it such revels for the feelings. They will smile, those rigorous spirits, when anyone says in their presence, "That thought elevates me, why should it not be true?" Or, "That work enchants me, why should it not be beautiful?" Or, "That artist enlarges me, why should he not be great?" Perhaps they will not only have a smile, but a genuine disgust for all that is thus rapturous, idealistic, feminine, and hermaphroditic. And if anyone could look into their inmost hearts, he would not easily find therein the intention to reconcile Christian sentiments with antique taste, or even with modern parliamentarianism, the kind of reconciliation necessarily found even among philosophers in our own very uncertain and consequently very conciliatory century. Critical discipline and every habit that conduces to purity and rigor in intellectual matters will not only be demanded from themselves by these philosophers of the future, they may even make a display thereof as their special adornment. Nevertheless, they will not want to be called critics on that account. It will seem to them no small indignity to philosophy to have it decreed, as is so welcome nowadays, that philosophy itself is criticism and critical science and nothing else whatever. Though this estimate of philosophy may enjoy the approval of all the positivists of France and Germany, and possibly it even flattered the heart and taste of Kant, let us call to mind the titles of his principal works. Our new philosophers will say, notwithstanding, that critics are instruments of the philosopher, and just on that account, as instruments, they are far from being philosophers themselves. Even the great Chinaman of Königsberg, Immanuel Kant, was only a great critic. I insist upon it that people finally cease confounding philosophical workers and, in general, scientific men with philosophers, that precisely here one should strictly give each his own and not give those far too much, these far too little. It may be necessary for the education of the real philosopher that he himself should have once stood upon all those steps upon which his servants, the scientific workers of philosophy, remain standing and must remain standing. He himself must perhaps have been critic and dogmatist and historian and besides poet and collector and traveler and riddle reader and moralist. And seer, and free spirit, and almost everything, in order to traverse the whole range of human values and estimations, and that he may be able, with a variety of eyes and consciences, to look from a height to any distance, from a depth up to any height, from a nook into any expanse. But all these are only preliminary conditions for his task. This task itself demands something else. It requires him to create values. The philosophical workers, after the excellent pattern of Kant and Hegel, have to fix and formalize some great existing body of valuations. That is to say, former determinations of value, creations of value, which have become prevalent and are for the time called truths, whether in the domain of the logical, the political, moral, or the artistic. It is for these investigators to make whatever has happened and been esteemed hitherto conspicuous, conceivable, intelligible, and manageable, to shorten everything long, even time itself, and to subjugate the entire past, an immense and wonderful task in the carrying out of which all refined pride, all tenacious will can surely find satisfaction. The real philosophers, however, are commanders and lawgivers. They say, thus shall it be. They determine first the whither and the why of mankind, and thereby set aside the previous labor of all philosophical workers and all subjugators of the past. They grasp at the future with a creative hand, and whatever is and was becomes for them thereby a means, an instrument, and a hammer. Their knowing is creating. Their creating is a law-giving. Their will to truth is will to power. Are there at present such philosophers? Have there ever been such philosophers? Must there not be such philosophers someday? It is always more obvious to me that the philosopher, as a man indispensable for the morrow and the day after the morrow, has ever found himself and has been obliged to find himself in contradiction to the day in which he lives. His enemy has always been the ideal of his day. Hitherto, all these extraordinary furtherers of humanity, whom one calls philosophers, who rarely regarded themselves as lovers of wisdom, but rather as disagreeable fools and dangerous interrogators, have found their mission, their hard, involuntary, imperative mission, in the end, however, the greatness of their mission, in being the bad conscience of their age. In putting the vivisector's knife to the breast of the very virtues of their age, they have betrayed their own secret. It has been for the sake of a new greatness of man, a new untrodden path to his aggrandizement. They have always disclosed how much hypocrisy, indolence, self-indulgence, and self-neglect, how much falsehood was concealed under the most venerated types of contemporary morality, how much virtue was outlived, they have always said. We must remove hence to where you are least at home. In the face of a world of modern ideas, which would like to confine everyone in a corner, in a specialty, a philosopher, if there could be philosophers nowadays, would be compelled to place the greatness of man, the conception of greatness, precisely in his comprehensiveness and multifariousness, in his all-roundness, and he would even determine worth and rank according to the amount and variety of that which a man could bear and take upon himself, according to the extent to which a man could stretch his responsibility. Nowadays, the taste and virtue of the age weaken and attenuate the will. Nothing is so adapted to the spirit of the age as weakness of will. Consequently, in the ideal of the philosopher, strength of will, sternness, and capacity for prolonged resolution must specially be included in the conception of greatness, with as good a right as the opposite doctrine with its ideal of a silly, renouncing, humble, selfless humanity was suited to an opposite age, such as the 16th century, which suffered from its accumulated energy of will and from the wildest torrents and floods of selfishness. In the time of Socrates, among men only of worn-out instincts, old conservative Athenians who let themselves go for the sake of happiness, as they said, for the sake of pleasure, as their conduct indicated, and who had continually on their lips the old pompous words to which they have long forfeited the right by the life they led, irony was perhaps necessary for greatness of soul. The wicked Socratic assurance of the old physician and plebeian, who cut ruthlessly into his own flesh as into the flesh and heart of the noble, with a look that said plainly enough, "Do not dissemble before me. Here, we are equal." At present, on the contrary, when throughout Europe the herding animal alone attains to honors and dispenses honors, when equality of right can too readily be transformed into equality in wrong, I mean to say, into general war against everything rare, strange, and privileged, against the higher man, the higher soul, the higher duty, the higher responsibility, the creative plenipotence and lordliness, at present it belongs to the conception of greatness to be noble, to wish to be apart, to be capable of being different, to stand alone, to have to live by personal initiative, and the philosopher will betray something of his own ideal when he asserts, "He shall be greatest who can be the most solitary, the most concealed, the most divergent, the man beyond good and evil, the master of his virtues and of superabundance of will. Precisely this shall be called greatness, as diversified as can be entire, as ample as can be full." And to ask once more the question, is greatness possible nowadays? It is difficult to learn what a philosopher is, because it cannot be taught. One must know it by experience, or one should have the pride not to know it. The fact that at present people all talk of things of which they cannot have any experience is true more especially and unfortunately as concerns the philosopher and philosophical matters. The very few know them, are permitted to know them, and all popular ideas about them are false. Thus, for instance, the true philosophical combination of a bold, exuberant spirituality which runs at presto pace and a dialectic rigor and necessity which makes no false step is unknown to most thinkers and scholars from their own experience, and therefore, should anyone speak of it in their presence, it is incredible to them. They conceive of every necessity as troublesome, as a painful compulsory obedience and state of constraint. Thinking itself is regarded by them as something slow and hesitating, almost as a trouble, and often enough as worthy of the sweat of the noble, but not at all as something easy and divine, closely related to dancing and exuberance. To think and to take a matter seriously, arduously, that is one and the same thing to them. Such only has been their experience. Artists have here, perhaps, a finer intuition. They, who know only too well that precisely when they no longer do anything arbitrarily and everything of necessity, their feeling of freedom, of subtlety, of power, of creatively fixing, disposing, and shaping, reaches its climax. In short, that necessity and freedom of will are then the same thing with them. There is, in fine, a gradation of rank in psychical states, to which the gradation of rank in the problems corresponds, and the highest problems repel ruthlessly everyone who ventures too near them, without being predestined for their solution by the loftiness and power of his spirituality. Of what use is it for nimble, everyday intellects or clumsy, honest mechanics and empiricists to press, in their plebeian ambition, close to such problems and, as it were, into this holy of holies, as so often happens nowadays? But coarse feet must never tread upon such carpets. This is provided for in the primary law of things. The doors remain closed to those intruders, though they may dash and break their heads thereon. People have always to be born to a high station, or, more definitely, they have to be bred for it. A person has only a right to philosophy, taking the word in its higher significance, in virtue of his descent. The ancestors, the blood, decide here also. Many generations must have prepared the way for the coming of the philosopher. Each of his virtues must have been separately acquired, nurtured, transmitted, and embodied. Not only the bold, easy, delicate course and current of his thoughts, but above all, the readiness for great responsibilities, the majesty of ruling glance and contemning look, the feeling of separation from the multitude with their duties and virtues, the kindly patronage and defense of whatever is misunderstood and calumniated, be it God or devil, the delight and practice of supreme justice, the art of commanding, the amplitude of will, the lingering eye, which rarely admires, rarely looks up, rarely loves. Chapter 7. Our Virtues. Our virtues. Is it probable that we, too, have still our virtues, although naturally they are not those sincere and massive virtues, on account of which we hold our grandfathers in esteem and also at a little distance from us? We Europeans of the day after tomorrow, we firstlings of the 20th century, with all our dangerous curiosity, our multifariousness and art of disguising, our mellow and seemingly sweetened cruelty in sense and spirit, we shall, presumably, if we must have virtues, have those only which have come to agreement with our most secret and heartfelt inclinations, with our most ardent requirements. Well then, let us look for them in our labyrinths, where, as we know, so many things lose themselves, so many things get quite lost. And is there anything finer than to search for one's own virtues? Is it not almost to believe in one's own virtues? But this believing in one's own virtues, is it not practically the same as what was formerly called one's good conscience? That long, respectable pigtail of an idea, which our grandfathers used to hang behind their heads and often enough also behind their understandings. It seems, therefore, that however little we may imagine ourselves to be old-fashioned and grandfatherly, respectable in other respects, in one thing we are, nevertheless, the worthy grandchildren of our grandfathers. We last Europeans with good consciences, we also still wear their pigtail. Ah, if you only knew how soon, so very soon, it will be different. As in the stellar firmament, there are sometimes two suns which determine the path of one planet, and, in certain cases, suns of different colors shine around a single planet, now with red light, now with green, then simultaneously illumine and flood it with motley colors, so we modern men, owing to the complicated mechanism of our firmament, are determined by different moralities. Our actions shine alternately in different colors and are seldom unequivocal. And there are often cases, also, in which our actions are motley colored. To love one's enemies? I think that has been well learnt. It takes place thousands of times at present on a large and small scale. Indeed, at times the higher and sublimer thing takes place. We learn to despise when we love, and precisely when we love best. All of it, however, unconsciously, without noise, without ostentation, with the shame and secrecy of goodness, which forbids the utterance of the pompous word and the formula of virtue. Morality, as attitude, is opposed to our taste nowadays. This is also an advance, as it was an advance in our fathers, that religion as an attitude finally became opposed to their state, including the enmity and Voltairean bitterness against religion, and all that formerly belonged to freethinker pantomime. It is the music in our conscience, the dance in our spirit, to which Puritan litanies, moral sermons, and goody-goodness won't chime. Let us be careful in dealing with those who attach great importance to being credited with moral tact and subtlety in moral discernment. They never forgive us if they once have made a mistake before us or even with regard to us. They inevitably become our instinctive calumniators and detractors, even when they still remain our friends. Blessed are the forgetful, for they get the better even of their blunders. The psychologists of France, and where else are there still psychologists nowadays, have never yet exhausted their bitter and manifold enjoyment of the bourgeois stupidity, just as though, in short, they betray something thereby. Flaubert, for instance, the honest citizen of Rouen, neither saw, heard, nor tasted anything else in the end. It was his mode of self-torment and refined cruelty. As this is growing wearisome, I would now recommend, for a change, something else for a pleasure, namely the unconscious astuteness with which good, fat, honest mediocrity always behaves towards loftier spirits and the tasks they have to perform. The subtle, barbed, Jesuitical astuteness, which is 1,000 times subtler than the taste and understanding of the middle class in its best moments, subtler even than the understanding of its victims. A repeated proof that instinct is the most intelligent of all kinds of intelligence which have hitherto been discovered. In short, you psychologists, study the philosophy of the rule in its struggle with the exception. There, you have a spectacle fit for gods and godlike malignity. Or, in plainer words, practice vivisection on good people, on the man of goodwill, on yourselves. The practice of judging and condemning morally is the favorite revenge of the intellectually shallow on those who are less so. It is also a kind of indemnity for their being badly endowed by nature. And finally, it is an opportunity for acquiring spirit and becoming subtle. Malice spiritualizes. They are glad in their inmost heart that there is a standard according to which those who are over-endowed with intellectual goods and privileges are equal to them. They contend for the equality of all before God and almost need the belief in God for this purpose. It is among them that the most powerful antagonists of atheism are found. If anyone were to say to them, "A lofty spirituality is beyond all comparison with the honesty and respectability of a merely moral man," it would make them furious. I shall take care not to say so. I would rather flatter them with my theory that lofty spirituality itself exists only as the ultimate product of moral qualities, that it is a synthesis of all qualities attributed to the merely moral man, after they have been acquired singly through long training and practice, perhaps during a whole series of generations. That lofty spirituality is precisely the spiritualizing of justice and the beneficent severity which knows that it is authorized to maintain gradations of rank in the world, even among things, and not only among men. Now that the praise of the disinterested person is so popular, one must, probably not without some danger, get an idea of what people actually take an interest in and what are the things generally which fundamentally and profoundly concern ordinary men, including the cultured, even the learned, and perhaps philosophers also, if appearances do not deceive. The fact thereby becomes obvious that the greater part of what interests and charms higher natures and more refined and fastidious tastes seems absolutely uninteresting to the average man. If, notwithstanding, he perceive devotion to these interests, he calls it disinterested and wonders how it is possible to act disinterestedly. There have been philosophers who could give this popular astonishment a seductive and mystical otherworldly expression, perhaps because they did not know the higher nature by experience, instead of stating the naked and candidly reasonable truth that disinterested action is very interesting and interested action, provided that and love, what? Even an action for love's sake shall be unegoistic? But you fools! And the praise of the self-sacrificer? But whoever has really offered sacrifice knows that he wanted and obtained something for it, perhaps something from himself for something from himself, that he relinquished here in order to have more there, perhaps in general to be more or even feel himself more. But this is a realm of questions and answers in which a more fastidious spirit does not like to stay. For here, truth has to stifle her yawns so much when she's obliged to answer. And after all, truth is a woman. One must not use force with her. "It sometimes happens," said a moralistic pedant and trifle retailer, "that I honor and respect an unselfish man, not, however, because he is unselfish, but because I think he has a right to be useful to another man at his own expense. In short, the question is always who he is and who the other is. For instance, in a person created and destined for command, self-denial and modest retirement, instead of being virtues, would be the waste of virtues, so it seems to me. Every system of unegoistic morality, which takes itself unconditionally and appears to everyone, not only sins against good taste, but is also an incentive to sins of omission, an additional seduction under the mask of philanthropy, and precisely a seduction and injury to the higher, rarer, and more privileged types of men. Moral systems must be compelled, first of all, to bow before the gradations of rank. Their presumption must be driven home to their conscience until it is thoroughly understood at last that it is immoral to say that what is right for one is proper for another." So said my moralistic pedant and simple man. Did he perhaps deserve to be laughed at when he thus exhorted systems of morals to practice morality? But one should not be too much in the right if one wishes to have the laughers on one's own side. A grain of wrong pertains even to good taste. Wherever sympathy, fellow suffering, is preached nowadays, and, if I gather rightly, no religion is any longer preached, let the psychologist have his ears open through all the vanity, through all the noise which is natural to these preachers, as to all preachers, he will hear a hoarse, groaning, genuine note of self-contempt. It belongs to the overshadowing and uglifying of Europe, which has been on the increase for a century, the first symptoms of which are already specified documentarily in a thoughtful letter of Galliani to Madame d'Epinay, if it is not really the cause thereof. The man of modern ideas, the conceited ape, is excessively dissatisfied with himself. This is perfectly certain. He suffers, and his vanity wants him only to suffer with his fellows. The hybrid European, a tolerably ugly plebeian, taken all in all, absolutely requires a costume. He needs history as a storeroom of costumes. To be sure, he notices that none of the costumes fit him properly. He changes and changes. Let us look at the 19th century with respect to these hasty preferences and changes in its masquerades of style, and also with respect to its moments of desperation on account of nothing suiting us. It is in vain to get ourselves up as romantic, or classical, or Christian, or Florentine, or Barocco, or national, in morals and arts. It does not clothe us. But the spirit, especially the historical spirit, profits even by this desperation. Once and again, a new sample of the past or of the foreign is tested, put on, taken off, packed up, and above all studied. We are the first studious age in puncto of costumes. I mean, as concerns morals, articles of belief, artistic tastes, and religions. We are prepared as no other age has ever been for a carnival in the grand style, for the most spiritual festival, laughter and arrogance, for the transcendental height of supreme folly and Aristophanic ridicule in the world. Perhaps we are still discovering the domain of our invention just here, the domain where even we can still be original, probably as parodists of the world's history and as God's Mary Andrews. Perhaps, though nothing else of the present have a future, our laughter itself may have a future. The historical sense, or the capacity for divining quickly the order of rank of the valuations according to which a people, a community, or an individual has lived, the divining instinct for the relationship of these valuations, for the relation of the authority of the valuations to the authority of the operating forces. This historical sense, which we Europeans claim as our specialty, has come to us in the train of the enchanting and mad semi-barbarity into which Europe has been plunged by the democratic mingling of classes and races. It is only the 19th century that has recognized this faculty as its sixth sense. Owing to this mingling, the past of every form and mode of life and of cultures which were formerly closely contiguous and superimposed on one another flows forth into us modern souls. Our instincts now run back in all directions. We ourselves are a kind of chaos. In the end, as we have said, the spirit perceives its advantage therein. By means of our semi-barbarity in body and in desire, we have secret access everywhere, such as a nobler age never had. We have access above all to the labyrinth of imperfect civilizations and to every form of semi-barbarity that has at any time existed on earth. And insofar as the most considerable part of human civilization hitherto has just been semi-barbarity, the historical sense implies almost the sense and instinct for everything, the taste and tongue for everything, whereby it immediately proves itself to be an ignoble sense. For instance, we enjoy Homer once more. It is perhaps our happiest acquisition that we know how to appreciate Homer, whom men of distinguished culture, as the French of the 17th century, like Saint-Evremond, who reproached him for his vast spirit, and even Voltaire, the last echo of the century, cannot and could not so easily appropriate, whom they scarcely permitted themselves to enjoy. The very decided yea and nay of their palate, their promptly ready disgust, their hesitating reluctance with regard to everything strange, their horror of the bad taste, even of lively curiosity, and, in general, the averseness of every distinguished and self-sufficing culture to avow a new desire, a dissatisfaction with its own condition, or an admiration of what is strange. All this determines and disposes them unfavorably even towards the best things of the world, which are not their property or could not become their prey. And no faculty is more unintelligible to such men than just this historical sense, with its truckling plebeian curiosity. The case is not different with Shakespeare, that marvelous Spanish, Moorish, Saxon synthesis of taste,